You're listening to the Exploring Research Careers podcast, the podcast that talks to people about their research careers and also explores personal histories of those who support researchers. In this episode of Exploring Research Careers, I speak with Dunal Hernan, who completed his PhD in aeronautical engineering in 2006. From there, he moved into Nokia Bell Labs as a postdoc and gradually, over the years, moved into more senior leadership roles. He speaks globally on a variety of topics, has been involved in numerous company change culture projects, culminating in the project he finds himself working on today, which is a global collaboration with artists and scientists named Experiments in the Arts and Technology. He talks to us about the reality of working in research in an industry setting, the impact of doing an MBA on his career, the characteristics and attributes he's noticed that successful postdocs and researchers possess, how he stays creative himself, and he provides career advice and life lessons for those students and researchers from arts to science. Dunal, you're very welcome to the podcast. Thanks so much for giving me your time. Can you talk us through the thought process that was going on for you as you embarked on the journey beginning at your PhD and through those couple of years?
I'll tell you a little bit about maybe the context, a bit of the backstory around what got me to the decision to do a PhD and what I did after my PhD, because I think that you have to understand where you've come from, your experience. That informs where you might want to go. You have to understand your interest deeply. So let me share a little bit about that, because I don't think people talk enough about the context and the backstory, which is critical. So my interest very young started off with space and astronomy and the planets and all of that, learning about the universe and being extremely curious about that side of things. As a young person, I thought that was probably a thing I'd like to work on. But the older I got, especially growing up in Ireland, the more I realized that space was just too alien, pardon the pun, to what I could achieve in Ireland. And at the same time, I started becoming very interested in airplanes. And I'm from the west coast of Ireland in a small village in Sligo, and I would be standing out my back garden looking up at the sky, and I'd see the planes passing over from Dublin to the US at 40,000 foot. And I just became mesmerized by the magic of that. I mean, how is that even possible? So I never wanted to fly, but very young, like 14, I knew I wanted to know how to make airplanes fly, how to design airplanes. And that became my big passion, because that kind of became a realistic goal for me. That was something slightly more tethered to Earth rather than the space thing, which I knew of no one in an Irish context that was.
I guess you could see an aeroplane.
I could see an aeroplane. I knew of people that worked in the industry in different ways, or they were more easily accessible to me. So the whole concept was of extreme interest to satisfy my curiosity how airplanes fly, somewhat related to my interest in space. Where, I mean, shuttles have to fly through air to get to space. So I started seeing this thing that was a bit more realistic that I was super interested in. So I was very lucky, very young. I said to myself, I want to know how to make airplanes fly. I don't want to fly them. I've flown airplanes since, never had an interest in that. I find it immensely boring. But I was fascinated by, even though I didn't know the name for it then, but aerodynamics. How does airflow move over a plane? How does airflow move through a jet engine? How is it possible that this chunk of metal can fly 40,000 foot above me when I'm in Sligo and all these people, hundreds of people are traveling from Dublin to America or wherever, right, all over the world? And it's magic, right? So that was the initial thing that kind of really piqued my interest. And I said very young, I want to do that in college. I want to become an expert in that thing. And then I started looking for what were the undergraduate degrees. And at the time, there was only one in the Republic. I still think there is at the University of Limerick. I also looked at Queen's in Belfast, and I also looked at some opportunities in the UK. And I ended up going to the one in Limerick, thankfully. Did my undergraduate, and very early on in my undergraduate degree, because it was a very broad, the first 2 years are very broad, where we do exactly the same degree as mechanical engineering, as aeronautical, which is I did, the program I did. And I realized that I had not just lack of interest, but an extreme disinterest in the mechanics, solid of mechanics, materials kind of thing. And I gravitated even more towards the fluid dynamics and the aerodynamics. I just had an immense interest in it. It just I mean, it wasn't work to me to do study on that or do my projects and all that kind of thing. And very early on, and this might have even happened before I started my undergraduate, but I said to myself, for some reason, I wanted to be a world leader in designing airplanes. I don't know where that came from, but I said, if I'm going to do something, I wanted to be one of the best in the world. And I couldn't tell you where that motivation came from, honestly. So before I even knew what a PhD was, I kind of knew I wanted to do a PhD. But then when I went and started doing my undergraduate, I was exposed to that. And I just knew straight away. I mean, very early on in my first year in college, I knew, okay, I have to do this PhD thing. To become a world expert, typically you have to do that kind of further study. And I know exactly what I'm going to do it in. And I could tell you exactly today the very specific area of fluid dynamics or aerodynamics that I was very keenly interested in. And that early interest was the thing that informed every decision I made after that. In other words, what were my, I don't know what they're called back home, but my electives or what were the special subjects I did when I had a choice around a certain topic in a, like a project I would do in one of my courses, I would choose it to be in the thing that I knew I wanted to do as a PhD. And everything I did as best I could helped reinforce and put me on this path towards being the most impactful I could be in that area that I chose.
I'm wondering how often students of that age would be thinking like that, you know, that they would be so focused.
Yeah.
Like, I'm assuming you spoke with family, you spoke with people, they encouraged you, there was that kind of open dialogue, discussion that you were exposed to.
No, I just, it was in my head. And I've been very lucky. I mean, I admit I know very few people that had that kind of clarity.
Mm.
And I've been lucky my entire life that I just get this image in the back of my mind. It's hard to describe it, but I see I'm interested in something. I see a path, and I'll talk about this maybe later. I see a way for me to kind of show value or be of value. And then I get this image in the back of my head of how that might manifest, what it looks like. And then it's a matter of kind of turning that real. I mean, I just have to make decisions and make choices to actually manifest that path. So this is, I think, where people get stuck is a little bit is they might not realize what their real interests are initially. And I think there's ways to gauge that. And I often help and mentor students with this. And sometimes I ask questions in a way where they kind of go, oh, you know what? When you put it that way, yeah, that is my big interest. And they wouldn't have quite realized it that way because they don't think about it. So there's gauging what your real interest is. And then you have to think, well, if that's my interest, how do I want to make that my career? And then you have to start being a bit more strategic in your thinking. But I've always been lucky that I've known where I wanted to go. And then I figure out how I get there. And there's nothing that will stop me in doing that. And it's just really a clarity of purpose that I've been fortunate to have. And I know that a lot of people don't have that. I believe, though, through working with a lot of students and graduates and younger people as well, I believe there are tricks to help people navigate that. And I can talk about that later on a little. So the PhD then was, you know, okay, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. At that time, there was no PhDs in Limerick. I started looking abroad. I knew, no matter what, I was doing a PhD in this very particular area, and I was looking at a lot of options abroad. And then out of nowhere, and this is a theme I'll come back to, it actually wasn't out of nowhere. I mean, people might call it luck, but a PhD topic arose with funding in exactly the thing I wanted to do. Now, a lot of the folks that I know would have let that opportunity pass. They might not even have heard about it. But I had spent a long time getting to know and speaking to the lecturers at the university that were working in similar areas, talking to them about how we might get funding, talking to them about their upcoming PhDs, saying to them, this is the thing I want to do. Is this something that you can help me do? And how can we figure this out? And then when it came to it, when an actual funded PhD arose in exactly my area, I already had spoken to the people. They already knew of my keen interest. It was basically a done deal. But I had put in a lot of prep work in advance of that because I knew this was my life. This is my interest. I had set a vision in my head and nothing was going to stop me. It was either go to the UK, which I really was not looking forward to at all. I wasn't relishing that prospect.
Okay. But
that's what I would have had to have done if that's what had to be done to achieve what I wanted to achieve.
And the conversations that you would have been having up to that point, did they in some way help this opportunity materialize? I mean, was it the conversations you were having prompted them to have conversations that led to this PhD being available, or how did this PhD materialize?
No, I think it was just one of those things, you know, people might call it, you know, you could refer to it as coincidence or a bit of luck, but one of the lecturers, one of the junior at the time researchers in the university who was working in a similar area, was coming up in his own career and applying for funds to do this type of work. Didn't know if he would get it, had no track record on getting funding. He was applying for that anyway. In the meantime, in advance of that, I had already had a conversation with him. I spoke to a lecturer about this topic. They said, I'm not really doing that work anymore, but there's this guy, this postdoc who's doing this work. He's doing interesting work. You should speak to him.
Okay.
Spoke with him. And that's just, I mean, it was just what happens. The funny thing about luck is, and I'm sure that there's sayings and quotes around this, but what's the expression? The more I practice, the luckier I get. I view it the same. It's not a practice thing, but it's, I just talk to people. And I, even young, even though I didn't know it then, but I would have networked in a way without even realizing it. And I just knew I wanted this thing. I had to make it happen. It wasn't just going to fall in my lap. And how I made it happen was by speaking to enough people. And when the opportunity arose, first, I was aware of it. Second, I could action it. Third, they were aware of me and my keen interest. And all of a sudden, magically, all the planets align. But the planets don't magically align. You have to put in the work and you have to be purposeful about how you spend your energy. And that's a really big life lesson that I have for myself and that I would share with others. Like, random stuff happens to you if you're random in your action. If you're very purposeful and how you expend your energy, good things will happen.
Okay. So at that point, was there an intention for you to remain in academia, or were you always thinking I'll go into industry, or?
Yep. So no, I wanted to go into industry. My big dream was to work for Boeing or Lockheed Martin, who were the two really big players in the aerospace aeronautics side of things back when I was graduating. So in my mind, I had a full intention to have to move to the States to work for them. And again, that was a sacrifice I would have happily made. So there's a bit of a story then. This is another kind of story around making things happen in a way, even though you might not quite realize it at the time. So that was my full intention. I was doing my PhD. That was my dream. And in my third year, I was traveling to a conference or something, and I came back and a strange person, not a strange man, but he was strange to the PhD program, clearly a lot older than us doing the PhD. He was sitting beside me in a room where we had 10 or 12 of us sharing a room doing PhDs in our desks. And there was this older man there who no one really knew. And I came back and I said hello and shared my name. He shared his name. He told me who he worked for, and it meant nothing to me. It was this Bell Labs something, part of Lucent or something. I was like, okay, whatever. So I had a big deadline I had to submit for a journal paper, and I had like 2 weeks worth of testing to do. And then I had to write it up as I was going along, and I had this 2 week deadline. And I was in another building doing all of my testing, you know, 14 hours a day, crazy kind of stuff. You know, sometimes it happens when you do a PhD, it's necessary evil. And after I came back, I pressed submit on the paper. And the very first thing I did is I turned to him and I said, look, I'm really sorry. I wasn't trying to be rude or anything. I had this crazy deadline. This is the work I'm doing. I've just submitted it. And I'd love to know more about, you know, why are you here? Like, what are you doing at Limerick? And it turns out he was on a 2 month sabbatical from Bell Labs, who I learned was this research division of a corporate called Lucent at the time, who were a really big, well-known tech company in telecommunications. And he was mentoring a few PhD students at Limerick. And he had just moved to Ireland from the US because Bell Labs had set up their first foreign research lab in Dublin. And he was mentoring students and building relationships and getting access to a pipeline of talent. And this was the very earliest stages of Bell Labs being set up in Dublin. So I just spoke to him, right? That's what people do, I think, right? Most of the time.
I think we're all encouraged to do that.
Yeah. But, you know, PhDs don't.
Exactly.
And PhDs in engineering and science don't. So with all of my friends, the 10 or 11 of them sharing the room, who all had spent 2 weeks in the room with him prior to me coming back from my conference or something, they hadn't spoken a word to him. They didn't know who he was. They didn't know what he did. They didn't know why he was there. They might at best nod hello to him when he came in the morning, but that was it. So I spoke to him, as humans do, got to know about him. And then he goes, oh, you should put in an application for a job at Bell Labs. We're setting up this whole new research division in Bell Labs, first of its kind, in this area called thermal science, which I didn't really know much about. And I was like, nah, you're okay. I want to work for Boeing or Lockheed. I've got 6 or 8 months left on my PhD. Super focused on finishing my write-up, getting this job. Thank you. I really appreciate you saying that, but it just doesn't seem like a good fit. So I get talking to him more, learning more about him and his research. Now I'm starting to get interested, start learning more about Bell Labs, and I realize, oh, this Bell Labs place is a big deal. You know, Lucent is a big deal, whatever. And I start learning about the history with 9 Nobel or 8 Nobel Prizes at that time, or maybe even 7 at that time. They've got a couple since, whatever. And, you know, it kind of, oh, this is interesting. I'm learning here. There's an opportunity. So then he says,
for those who might be listening, Dunal, just in terms of, because people might know about Nokia, not everyone might know about Bell Labs, and some people might think, oh, Nokia, they used to make phones. Can you give us a one or two liner about what they do?
So, Bell Labs is the research division. Now our parent company is Nokia. You hear me refer to Lucent back in this timeline because that was the parent company, but Nokia acquired Lucent. So Nokia are famous for the, you know, cell phones of yonder year, but today they're a global leader in telecommunications. So when you think about 5G technology, Nokia is one of the top three in the world for making that equipment and supplying it. So our big customers would be BT and Vodafone and AT&T and Verizon and those kind of there. So typically when you connect your phone to the internet or to another phone and make a conversation or a text, there's a very high probability it's Nokia equipment that's making that happen behind the scenes.
Great.
So Bell Labs is the long-term fundamental research division. We employ PhDs to take our fundamental knowledge of different sciences and try and do something that would be of unique value to the parent company in the future. And future could be 5, 10, 15, 20 years, depending on the project. So I get to know this guy. And then one day he goes, because I'm just chatting, right, as people should do. And he goes, you know, I've got two colleagues visiting from the US. You know, would you share with them the work you're doing? So I said, oh, sure. I'm going to talk to anyone about my work. So I gave a presentation. Seemed to go well. Didn't think much of it. And then they said, we'd like you to interview for a role. Now, this was very interesting to me because I thought, this is great. I'll do an interview with this crowd, this Bell Labs crowd. I'll get experience in doing a serious interview, and I'll use that experience to get my dream job in the States. So I go on, I do the interview, and I do a lot of research on the company and Bell Labs and everything. And now I'm super intrigued by the history and the type of organization it is. And, you know, it's just outstanding history, more impactful than Lockheed or Boeing ever were. And they're two spectacular companies. So now I'm really intrigued. I do the interview, though, and it goes fine. It was basically a 24-hour interview. I went for dinner with the team I would work with the night before, did all day 9 to 6 or even 8 to 6 interviews and a presentation with a lot of people. And then I got invited out to a one-year celebration of Bell Labs being in Ireland that very night, for dinner with everyone. So I kind of was like almost a 24-hour interview, and it went fine. Didn't think much of it. Didn't think I'd get offered the role because my area of expertise was in aerodynamics, and this was a role in what's called thermal science, so cooling down electronics and things like that. But they wanted my knowledge of airflow to help them do the thermal science thing. So I get offered the job, and then I say, oh, this is great. You know what? I'll do a postdoc with Bell Labs for a year for experience so I can get my dream job in the States. And to cut a long story short, I'm there almost 15 years later, and I've worked on a lot of different things because I've been afforded the opportunities, and I've also seeked out new challenges and things like that we can talk about. But that was my journey. So I went into industry, always wanted to go into industry. And the reason was I loved my research. I loved fundamental research. I loved doing a PhD. I loved the fact that I was the first person in the world to do certain things, analyze data in a certain way, take data in a way, and then be able to prove a thing that no one else could prove at the time. It was like, I love that. But I always wanted that knowledge to help me do something quote unquote real. But what I mean by real is industry product, something physically touching consumers, right? Research in academia is all about knowledge, and all of that is great, but it's rare that you get the opportunity to have that knowledge actually, in the nearer term, impact humanity, right? Through an actual interface with humans, in other words, a product of some sort. And I was super interested in applying my fundamental knowledge to provide differentiation in a product kind of setting, in an industry setting.
And when you moved into that position, how did things change from when you were doing your PhD to that first year in terms of, you know, for people who are listening, how they have to be different, you know, their interactions are different. Like you mentioned, we should be speaking to each other. We should be asking people questions. How did things for you change day to day, month to month?
Yeah, so I would say they changed pretty easy for me because you might get a sense that I had an inclination towards doing maybe communicating a slightly different way anyway. But I started with other people and I know other people and they kind of struggled. They found it very difficult. They went from an individual PhD where you're largely completely dependent on yourself. And they went then into an environment where they were part of a team, had to communicate not with people from other disciplines, had to communicate with people from other parts of the business, whether they're product or otherwise. And all of this kind of change now where no longer they're self-sufficient, and they have to be part of a bigger thing. And that really was a big challenge for a lot of people. And I saw people significantly struggle with that because they were never educated or told, oh, by the way, when you're doing a PhD in academia, this is kind of how you operate. But when you go into industry, that's typically not rewarded. Or you might just do okay. You might be allowed to do your research, but you won't really progress. You won't really get the opportunities unless you shift your perspective in these kind of ways. So I was just always curious. I observed a lot of things. My earliest interactions I can remember to this day being in meetings with my management who were in the company a very long time, them being on phone calls with our product designers in another part of the business, and our researchers, our managers, speaking in terms of equations. And I'm not exaggerating. I mean, they were trying to present an idea to the business, the product team. These are teams that are under immense pressure on a quarterly basis to, you know, get product out and solve problems and make revenue. And our researchers were talking about the Navier-Stokes equation and when you consider the derivative of the density and the whatever. And I was just there going, I mean, how, and I know on the podcast you can't see my face, but it's like just immense levels of confusion where even at that stage, I just knew that can't be the best way to communicate to these folks because they didn't do a PhD. They don't operate in terms of speaking in equations. They have different constraints and needs and wants, and it's not a good idea to try and communicate to them in that very narrow way. So I immediately had, I would say frustrations, and we can talk about frustrations a bit later. I was quite frustrated with the approach, and it really stuck with me how, I would say, inefficient I felt that approach was, or how there would be a better approach. And I made it my business to go about the way I did research and the way I interact with people in a very different way.
Was there feedback coming from the company for them to say you need to adapt how you approach things, or was there a sense that they had to try to figure that out on their own?
There wasn't direct feedback, but what happened was they weren't really making traction. They weren't having impact. They weren't gaining interest from the other side, the side they were trying to quote unquote sell to. Right? I mean, everyone's selling in every context. In this context, we were trying to sell our research, sell an idea, get them behind it so that people in the company would view that our research actually might have some downstream impact, right? It's a very important thing to do in our context, in industry. So what I realized was it was very clear that it wasn't going well because of the lack of engagement, the lack of interaction. The business unit folks always had this notion, oh, they're PhDs, they're super smart. They're so much smarter than me. How could I possibly tell them that their idea is nonsense? So there was always this bit of a bubble around researchers, which I think is really dangerous, right? But they would never give direct feedback. But what would happen is when you would engage them in a different way, and when I engaged them in a different way, and I spoke to them in a way that I felt they would resonate with them, now what happened was the feedback would come very fast and very quick, but it was very positive. In other words, what they would end up saying is to leaders in Bell Labs, they would end up saying, I just had an interaction with the person that's part of that team in Ireland, and it's the first time in 20 years that anyone in Bell Labs has ever been able to explain to me what it is they actually do and why, and how what they do today is going to help my business in 5 years. And then all of a sudden, there was a bit of this change where leadership in the lab started realizing that there's these people in Ireland that are kind of doing things a different way. Let's pay attention to that, because of the positive feedback coming from the business, where at all levels the business was saying, we've never interacted with Bell Labs this way before. Why can't it be more of this? This is the future. We will support you, Bell Labs. We will support your research. We'll understand it more if you could engage with us this way more. And we kind of laid a whole culture change initiative across Bell Labs globally in that approach to working with our business unit partners.
Wow. Can you talk to me about the MBA and how that evolved and why you felt that was a necessary step?
Yeah, so I had, at that stage, I had, you know, I was a researcher, postdoc, then made permanent researcher, then became a technical manager. And at that stage, I was director level of research, had created a whole new research department across three kind of scientific disciplines, grew, you know, pretty big team in a short period of time, and had a lot of exposure to the business and Bell Labs at a very senior level and all this good stuff, you know, invited to special.
Can I just interject and ask you, were you at that point saying, God, I'm really living the dream here? This is kind of what I, or were you still thinking Boeing is going to come along any minute and offer me that job?
No, at this stage, I'd firmly moved away. I always had a connection to aerodynamics because that was part of the work we did for this industry. But the notion of working for one of those companies left me because I saw so much opportunity in Bell Labs. And I was given a lot of opportunity. I mean, I stuck my head above, right? I put myself on the line, but then I was also given opportunity to grow and expand. Mm-hmm. So I just saw so many ways that I could have a lot of impact and I could grow personally, that notion of Boeing or Lockheed kind of went out the window.
Mm-hmm. But were you saying, oh my God, I'm in this amazing place and I get to do this every day, and, you know, like those kind of internal conversations?
I, to some extent, but so yes, but also no. So there's a personality thing, I guess, that should be explained, that I'm almost never happy. I'm almost never happy with what I've achieved, and I almost think that I've never achieved anything, if you know what I mean. So I'm kind of just one of those people, like if when I finished a project, I've already moved on to the next big thing way before that. And now that's the next big challenge. And I almost don't see, I'm always pushing myself, I'll put it that way. But at the time, I certainly, you know, I had very good friends that we did the PhD at the same time. I saw how they were working. I saw what was being expected of them, whether in academia or in industry. And I saw a big difference in how I was able to grow. I mean, seriously grow, given a lot of responsibility at a very young age in this organization compared to the responsibilities they would have had or been expected of them. So I certainly knew that I was kind of privileged in that position, that I could pitch a big idea and there was a chance it would be supported and I could get to do all these things and be part of all of these strategic discussions and driving, having discussions even with HR about culture change across Bell Labs globally. And my friends at the same age as me and same level of qualification, they weren't being given that level of responsibility. So that side of it, yeah, absolutely. I saw that I kind of operated in a privileged position compared to most.
And the MBA evolved out of that, or that was?
Well, the MBA, so from day one, I had this different approach to my research. I had a different approach to communication. I spent a lot of time building relationships with our product teams, whereas most of the other researchers in our location and Bell Labs globally didn't. They just were happy sitting at their computer in their lab doing research. So I always had that inclination. I found it very interesting. I kind of knew that to have impact, I would have to build that relationship, right? I mean, how can I turn my research into a product if I don't get to learn the constraints on the product side? So I just knew I had to grow and learn all that side of things. Did a lot of projects, a lot of transfer of our research, really built very strong relationships at a very senior level. I was a director of research in Ireland, and I got this inclination, and this is maybe something we can come back to, but I was getting this spider sense that I needed to have the next challenge. And I started thinking quite early on, well, what could be the next thing? Where might I want to go and grow? What change would I have to make today so that that thing becomes a reality when the time is right? And, you know, I had my undergrad in aeronautics and my PhD in aerodynamics. And I did a lot of dealings with the business, but I had no formal education on the business side. And I just thought this could be a very good opportunity for me to get formal grounding in things like accounting and strategy and finance and all those kind of great things, economics even. And I would learn and I would grow. And of course, it would be great on my resume. But at the same time, it would give me this credibility when I'm interfacing with the business. Now I have a lot of the experience. I clearly know the research and the technology, but now I would have a business grounding that would give me, build an even greater bridge, stronger bridge between me and the business side. So it was for all of those reasons. And I needed to be challenged. And I didn't want to be stagnant. I could, as I said, I could get this spider, the tingly spider senses of stagnation approaching. And if I get that sense, I know that I need to kind of push myself in another direction.
And was that the impact? Did the business side start to kind of speak or communicate with you in a different way? Or
no, not really. I mean, I communicated with them fairly optimally. Yeah. I just think there were certain opportunities where elements of the MBA, I'll put it this way, if I was in a meeting with a client or if I was in a meeting with a senior executive, and if they started talking about some particular strategy framework or something like that, I had all the knowledge. I could speak their lingo. I knew what they were saying. I wasn't going to meetings and like speaking like an MBA or on strategy or anything like that. But if I needed to, I had it there. And I never outwardly really used it, but I'm sure implicitly it was a great advantage to me. And honestly, I probably used it a lot without realizing it, if you know what I mean. I mean, I think that was like the MBA was an augmentation of a skill that I'd already developed, but it gave me this very strong grounding, and it just made me very comfortable in certain situations, and I could speak and understand the lingo when needed.
Mm-hmm. Would you talk a little bit about the skills that you started out with versus what you find the kind of skills that you're using now? So, for example, you've said you're always looking for the next challenge. How have you evolved? What do you use, or what kind of skills do you tend to be using nearly all the time now that you mightn't have had at the beginning?
Yeah, I mean, so through my undergrad and PhD, it's all about, right, physics and equations, right, and frameworks. And we're kind of, in the engineering science subjects, we're thought to be very reductive. And I would, describe it as linear and logical, right? I mean, you ask an engineer, how'd you go from A to D? And they'll say, I passed through B and C. And then you go through that through the kind of scientific method, which is well known and has been of great value to humanity. But what I find happens is, across the board, universally, is through that training, that reductive approach, you start thinking that all problems are technology problems and all solutions are technology solutions. And through our training, especially in a PhD, when it can be quite isolating, that you largely are responsible for your own success, right? Largely. You start thinking that the way you go about being successful in life is by being an individual contributor, and that you have to solve all of the problems yourself. So you start applying this reductive scientific method to, that's your world lens, your worldview, and you start applying this lens of, I'm the smartest person in the room. I'm the only one that can solve this problem. And the combination of both those things, I find, they've, as I said, the scientific method and all of that has given great benefit to humanity, but it can be extremely limiting for people and how they more broadly have impact. So what I ended up doing was very young. I started realizing before I became a manager, and especially when I became one, that the biggest challenge wasn't the technology, wasn't the research. The biggest challenge was people. And if you could get the people side of it right, other things just happened. And I started realizing for me to have the most impact I could have as an individual, I would have to become a leader of people, and I would have to become as good as I could be at that. And that meant understanding people dynamics and human complexity and all of that kind of thing. So I had a very immediate interest. Once I saw that connection, it's back to my earlier point. Once I realized that for me to have the impact I wanted, I have to become a people manager. And once I realized that, another dot I saw then was, well, that's very challenging. And the biggest challenge there is the people side, not the tech side. And if I can get the people side right, everything will be successful. All of a sudden now I have three points of information or three dots that I started connecting, realizing for me to be successful in that, I must become very knowledgeable and good at people dynamics, right? Just people in general. So I became automatically then just very curious, asking questions. Why did that person say that? Why did they do that? Why did they act that way? Why didn't they do this then? And I sought out people that I trusted and that I felt were very good at the people side of it, that were not very technical, but super strong at the people angle, the politics, what I might call the optics and the politics of being in an organization with other people. And I learned a lot from some of those people very early on what people call, quote unquote, the softer side, which I actually find the hardest side, or most people find it impossible. And a lot of technical people, especially PhDs, I think they subconsciously choose to ignore that side of it because they find it immensely difficult and complicated because it goes against all of their training and their natural inclinations.
I suppose there's a lot in that, isn't there? In the sense of, on one level, it sounds quite simplistic, but to deal with people, as you say, is one of the hardest things. But you're saying that once you kind of made those connections early on, that was something that you said, okay, this is going to warrant a lot of study by me, and I'm going to do it. So today, when you're in your office, or we're not in the office, but when you will get back into the office, mm-hmm. is that largely how you go about, I don't want to use the word manipulating people, but having relationships, you know, yeah. having that kind of relationship vibe that you talk with people, you network, you ask, you're curious.
Yeah, 100%. So it's just having an appreciation for the complexity of people. And often people do a PhD because they want to challenge themselves, or they're super interested in the complexity of the scientific thing that they're studying. And they don't realize that people around them are infinitely more complex than that thing that they're studying. So if you have an interest in complexity, people is the direction you should go, generally, right? That's my idea. Now, what I would say is, yeah, I realize. So there's what I notice with people is you can have there's a bifurcation in the path you can choose as a technology or a PhD, whatever you want to call it. You can go deep down the technology path. You can do your research the way you want to do it in industry and in academia for the rest of your life. You can research the same thing if you want, or you can do different things, but it's going to be you in your lab doing research. And then the extension of that is you can become a PI. You can write a lot of grants, get funding in, and have a lot of PhDs do the research, but it's still your research. Like that's, you're telling them what to do largely, you're helping them, and you're furthering your interest in that particular area. And that's all good if that's your interest. There's the other path, which is people leadership, right? And I realized for myself personally, early on, the challenge of the deep research side didn't speak to me anymore. I felt I did that in my PhD. Then I went and changed fields from aeronautical to thermal science, and I had to learn that whole new field. That was a good challenge. But once I got far enough into that, I started realizing, for me personally, it's a very personal thing, it no longer became a challenge to me to solve the technical problem. I just knew if I thought about it hard enough for long enough, I would come up with an answer. What became super challenging and of interest to me was the people side of it. And I'd never had anyone speak to me about that in all of my college and everything. It was a revelation to me to start being curious about all these interactions and complexities and what is going on with these people. And then I started realizing, and I told you from day one, right, I wanted to be the best in the world at a thing. And it happened to be, I felt I wanted to be the best airplane designer at that time. But as my knowledge grew and as I started learning more about the world, what I started realizing was, if I want to be the most impactful I can be, I need to be an extremely good leader of people. And to be an extremely good leader of people, I need to understand human complexity very well. And that was the basic logic that brought me to where I am today. So when you say, what do I do today that I do differently then? I still do root cause analysis. I try and still understand the relationships between different parts of the system. I still try and think about it from a system point of view. So I use a lot of the skills that I developed in a PhD. But what I find really interesting is I work with some of the smartest people in technology who are far smarter technologically than I could ever be. And there's a big technical physical issue, and they can apply root cause analysis and the scientific method to get to an answer and solve that. But if they're having an issue with a team member who they can't collaborate with, they're completely lost. They don't even know where to start. And I find it so interesting because the same root cause analysis approach and elements of the scientific method can be used to understand a person. But for some reason, engineers and scientists only apply that technique to physics or technology problems, never to people. So what I would say is, in a way, nothing has changed in how I work today. But in a way, everything has changed because my entire worldview, or the lens I think about everything through today, is people and strategy, we'll say, right? But that's a different thing entirely, in a way. But it's always around people. What motivates that person? What is that person's pain point? If I share my idea with that person, how can I help communicate to them in a way that they'll understand that my idea is actually going to be the solution to their problem? And this is their context of their level in the organization and the industry they're in. This is my view of what their pain points might be. All of that context now, here's my idea. How do I pitch it to them? How do I make them invest in my idea in a way that resonates with them? And people just don't typically think that way or ask those questions. But when you're dealing with a person and you want to have a mutually beneficial exchange with them, you either have to take 7 years building a relationship and you eventually get there, or you need to start asking questions of motivation and context and pain points and things like that. And I think, like, fundamentally, it's a root cause analysis type of thing, but it's not applied to tech or science, it's applied to people.
Okay. I'm thinking of the little boy looking at the aeroplane, thinking, I want to build them. And then this kind of almost different, well, totally different experience of people, and how can I get them to think the way I think or see what I can see? It's quite interesting. You're a creative advisor on lots of different projects. I've looked at your resume, and it's totally, I hear when you say you feel like you've never achieved anything and feel totally inadequate. But how do you spark your creativity? How do you maintain innovation?
Yeah, so for me, as I said to you earlier, I kind of, at a certain point, I feel like there's not much, or my ability to improve the area I'm working in or leading, I feel that the rate of growth or rate of improvement starts decreasing. So I know on the audio podcast, people can't see this, but I have my hand at an inclination, which is like a Y versus X, right? And it's a steep slope. And I'd like to operate in a steep slope of improvement and impact. And as soon as I start feeling that a point of that starts dropping off on the steepness of the slope, right, that it starts flattening, even the earliest inclination of that, I don't like being in that mode. I really like to be pushing myself in the mode of extreme discomfort.
Can you describe what that feels like when you kind of start to feel?
Yeah, it feels like I've never said this out loud before, but it feels like I already know what the problems are going to be, and I already know the solutions to the problems. What I would say is, another way, without sounding, that maybe is an arrogant sounding answer, I become extremely comfortable.
Okay.
And that's another way of saying, maybe a less arrogant way of saying, that I see the problems and I know the answers to the problems in advance, but I become very comfortable. I just know, I know all the people, I know all the tensions, I know how to navigate the choppy waters of whatever. I know how to pitch a new idea. I know who to go to first. I know who to go to second. I know everything. I know how to hire the right people. I know how to deal with HR. I just know all the systems and the processes and the procedures, and I know how to get what I want And I've just become super comfortable. And as soon as I start getting a sense that I'm entering that comfort zone, I just don't like that personally. It's not the place I want to be.
And how do you choose what's next? Like, how do you, like, what's the conversation as in, okay, I'm getting comfortable here. Like, how do you pick the next complex thing?
Yeah. So this is something I'll probably speak a little bit about later if I'm talking about lessons learned in life kind of thing. So there's stuff I talked about earlier, like talking to people, right? And I mentioned a few times to you that I'm extremely curious. So I just ask a lot of questions of a lot of things, and I'm really kind of get energized by being exposed to new ways of thinking and new everything. And I talk to a lot of people. Now, there's a funny thing that happens when you're curious and you talk to a lot of people. Magically, your kind of opportunity space explodes. All of a sudden now, you know a ton of people by definition and from a lot of different backgrounds. You've built trust and relationships with them because you're treating them like another human being. I know, shocker. You treat a human being like a human being and good things happen, right? But this is what engineers and scientists seem to forget about. It's not all about technology and equations. And then because you're curious, now all of a sudden you're kind of amplifying that, you're exposed to a lot of different perspectives. So what happens when you do that enough and you do it naturally, magically an opportunity arises that intersects with the interest that you've built up just naturally by being curious. And then it's up to you to make a decision to do something with that. So I can give you lots of examples. I give you a prime example, the most recent one, or the biggest most recent one that happened to me. When I was leading the team in Ireland, I was responsible for growing the team and hiring a lot of people. And I went about doing that in a very different way to the way it was traditionally done because of the deficits in the approach that was taken that I observed, at least my perspective on the way things could be done better, whether it was right or wrong. I ended up hiring a lot of people that had PhDs, but also had an extreme flair for creativity. They either had some creative arts hobby in the evening, or they went about their research in an extremely creative way. And I hired people that desperately wanted to turn their research into reality. In other words, have a new idea, do the fundamental research, publish on it, get patents, but also have it be a product. So we built a very strong big team, 18 people or so, I think, after a couple of years, who were from all different scientific backgrounds all over the world, although we were predominantly Irish. And luckily, there was great talent in Ireland that I could draw on in the local universities. And we had this melting pot of ideas and different ways of doing things. And we all helped each other as a team. And it was a spectacular, you know, team to be part of. And what I realized then was that exposure to those differences was immensely powerful. And at that time, we started doing our research in a way that no one had done in Bell Labs. We would do our fundamental research, PhD level, but we would then go and implement it as if it was an actual, we would build actual products and we would test our concepts in our actual products of our parent company with our product teams in Germany and in the US and everything. So we did it in a totally different way, but everything we did was aesthetically very pleasing, experientially very pleasing. You could touch and hear and feel our work, and it would look totally different, like a real product, right? So I had that natural thing that we did, and I got exposed to that. Then I became known as like a very collaborative, creative type of person in Bell Labs, and I started being invited to take part in lots of stuff. But because long story short, after my MBA, I moved to the States. I was asked to go there to do some culture change activities, and then magically what happened, again, one of these coincidences that you can either view as luck or you can think about it and question to what extent you made it happen. And it was 2016. I was only over there a few months, and there was this 50th anniversary of a very famous event that happened in Bell Labs 50 years prior in 1966, which was this first of its kind gathering of engineers and scientists from Bell Labs with artists from all over New York. It was called the Nine Evening of Theatre and Engineering. I won't go into it, but it was like a seminal moment bringing these worlds together. People in New York were celebrating the 50th anniversary. They reached out to Bell Labs, and we had kind of forgot about this part of Bell Labs history, honestly. So we look it up, and then we realize, oh, Bell Labs has played a critical role in bringing technology and the arts together throughout our history. we were having conversations about what we were missing in our research and how we were hiring people. And we kind of thought, okay, we should really find out more here. So, you know, I volunteered to be part of those meetups, went into New York, met with artists. Like, I just like meeting people and learning from them. Had some of the most spectacular conversations I've ever had in my life. And a massive light bulb went off on my mind. I had an undergrad, a PhD, and an MBA. I had all the experience working in a big multinational, worked with a lot of academics at this stage. You know, had all this experience in education, and I had these conversations with artists, and I realized that I knew nothing. Or at least I knew nothing about a whole different way of looking at the world and thinking about society and humanity and technology and all those things. I was completely blind to this entirely different way, even after all of my education and all my experience. And a massive light bulb moment went off and I went, oh, this is not good for me. I mean, I personally should know more about this. I should learn and grow. But then I started realizing, oh, wait a minute, everyone I know in every context that has a PhD or an undergrad in the sciences somehow, I mean, the hard physical sciences and engineering, they are completely blind to this. It's not part of our training. It's not part of our education. It's not part of how our employers expect us to do our work. And I realized, oh, I started, again, everything I see through a lens of impact in a way. If I learn about this, I can grow personally. I can help my employer grow. I can grow the entire area of STEM education, which is completely lacking this perspective, because I just learned about it and it blew my mind. And I knew that most people I've ever dealt with are similarly minded to me, same education. And I just started seeing now, this is a way that I can grow personally and I can have potentially immense impact if I put the energy in and actually do something about it. And that's exactly what I did. I started in a low-key way, a completely new initiative, bringing artists into our organization and beg, borrowed, and stole resources to help those artists, used it to dip our toes in the water to learn from it, grew it organically under the radar, and then a couple of years ago, left the job I was in, which I loved. I was head of what's called Innovation Incubation, because I saw such potential for this role and bringing the arts and the sciences and technology together, that I pitched to create an entirely new research lab just looking at art and technology. I hired a few people, and we went, you know, in a couple of years from absolutely nothing to working with around 25 artists. But again, I just had that moment where I saw there was knowledge that I didn't have. There was diverse people that I spoke to that helped me grow personally. And started having a keen interest and a curiosity about this different approach, started connecting dots, and then realized, oh, this could be the most impactful thing I could ever do in my life. This now became my really big mission, my purpose. And I started putting a plan in the back of my mind together for how I could go from nothing to something logically within, of course, the constraints of my employment and how I'm expected to show value and all of that, which is a whole different conversation. Mm. But that's kind of one exact example of how. But that only happened because I spoke to strangers, I was curious, and all of a sudden my knowledge grew in a certain new area. And then when knowledge grows, you can start connecting dots. And that's around more the purpose or the strategy side of your approach to your own career.
The artists that you talk about and you say about, you know, STEM, like, do you have other people on the team who come from other disciplines, let's say health sciences, English, education? Yeah. Like, you know, when you think about diversity of thought, do you have people who represent lots of different streams?
Yeah. So directly. So I have people on my team that are employed by our company, and then I have 25 artists that we work with. So the folks in our team, one is a music and technology background. She is an artist herself, but trained in music and technology. You might generically refer to her as a creative technologist who plays music, so very diverse background. And the other person, the guy, has an undergrad in philosophy and an MFA in music.
Okay.
Now, the artists we work with are as diverse as you could possibly imagine, or maybe not as fully diverse as representing all of humanity, but not far off that. We have an extremely diverse set of artists we work with. And I mean that not just from the way they use technology or their training, but I mean everything, where they come from in the world, their perspectives, their ethnicity, race, you name it. I mean, and it's true that what I call diversity of everything, where you can truly get to what I would describe as extreme levels of cognitive diversity. So you can't have cognitive diversity in an organization unless you have diversity in every dimension you could imagine that represents humanity. And all of that then comes together, and then the magical new ideas and creativity and quote-unquote innovation and new ways of doing things and solving problems and seeing the world in a new way, all of that emerges out of those differences coming together. And without those differences, it's just a bunch of the same people with the same thoughts coming up with the same problems and the same solutions in the same way.
One of the talks from last year was, why does it take a crisis to unlock innovation? And with that in mind, what advice would you give to one group, students, and maybe another group, researchers, who are listening and thinking, I don't know what I'm going to do with my career. What advice would you give to them? And we can talk a little bit more about lessons learned if you want to elaborate on that.
I think it's a common theme of what we've said now a few times. Or I'll say it another way. I wouldn't just let things happen to you. I mean, you know, when we talk about that innovation, why does it accelerate in a crisis? The reason is because a crisis is not the normal, right? It's as simple as that. Now, when people are operating in their normal mode, they're kind of going about their work, they're doing their 9-to-5, they're kind of focused on the thing they're currently doing at this moment in time. How many people are thinking about a year from now, 3 years from now, 5 years from now? How many people have a vision in their mind of where they want to go? Without a vision of where you want to go, things can't happen. I mean, they'll happen purely by fluke, or they won't happen at all, and you'll be very kind of frustrated and upset and questioning constantly, like, why aren't I doing better? Why isn't that professor acknowledging my work? Why didn't that journal paper get accepted? Why? You have to understand that that's kind of the way most people go about and they think. And they're kind of just sitting there, not really doing much proactively, not doing much purposefully, not doing much strategically. And they're kind of just hoping that things happen for them. And I personally find that bizarre. I would never, ever rely on something to just happen. I would always want to be a master of my own destiny. I would always want to be in control. And the whole lesson behind that talk, that collaboration I have around why does it take an innovation to spark, or why does it take a crisis to spark innovation and creativity, is to say that whether there's a crisis or not, you should be operating in the mode that there's a crisis. You know, I mean, you should never let anything just sit. You should never get, this is strictly my own personal feeling, but you shouldn't allow yourself to get too comfortable. Comfort is where innovation dies, and comfort is where creativity dies. You need to be pushing yourself. You need to be, I believe, if you want to achieve great things in that steep mode of learning, comfort will kill all of that, kills all motivation. You know, and then what happens is after a period of time, comfort becomes the norm and you can't even see that you're in this comfort zone. Now you start being blind to everything else around you. You don't see opportunities. You don't realize that you're not pushing yourself the way you used to. It just becomes this comfort blanket that kind of smothers you. And I would say to people, just be very careful. Don't expect things to just happen. You have to make them happen purposefully. And be very careful about allowing yourself to get comfortable, because, or at least what I would say is, make sure it's a conscious decision. If you make a conscious decision and you say, no, look, I've done my hard work, I'm happy doing things the way they're doing now, I'd happily do it for the rest of my time on this planet, that is absolutely fine. That's your conscious decision. But what I see a lot of people happen is they don't consciously realize that. They're very frustrated in life and lack of progression. But they've kind of allowed that comfort blanket to smother them, and they can't even see ways to get out of it. And that's something that I speak to a lot of people about and try and help them think their way out of that a lot. And it's easier if you just don't let yourself into that in the first place.
I was going to say, you almost need to hear somebody say it, you know, because if you're in it, you haven't thought about it, or you don't have the awareness. Yeah. And then it moves on and you move on, and then a year is gone, 2 years, and you're like, oh, and then you might hear somebody say it, or read a book or read an article or something. But it's not until that happens that you kind of can link them.
Yeah, exactly. And there's only way, one way you can do it proactively in advance of that happening is to consistently try and challenge yourself and make yourself, put yourself in uncomfortable situations. That is the only way. If you don't do that, you're naturally going to fall into the comfort zone.
On one hand, that sounds exhausting.
Well, it's only exhausting if you're applying your energy in an area that you're not passionate about, that you're not curious about, and that you don't see a potential for impact. I mean, I couldn't possibly put the energy into things unless I thought, well, I'm going to be, this is the way I can grow, and this is the way I can have impact. And unless you can see that, unless you think there's a higher probability that this path gets me to where I want to go, then it would be torture, right, to have to put that amount of energy in. But all of a sudden, when you start connecting those dots and seeing those opportunities, and you're curious about a topic and passionate about it, it's not really work then.
I suppose, what's next for you then when you talk about comfort, discomfort? What do you see happening for you next?
So as it stands, for the last 4 years, I've been, as I described, very keenly interested in this fusion of art and technology. And I've done a lot of work to bring these two worlds together. And I believe we're onto a kind of a winning, I don't mean to call it a framework, but in a winning approach to fuse these very different disciplines and overcome the tensions and barriers that exist and actually show real value, right? And my big challenge now is, how do I scale that an order of magnitude bigger than I've currently been able to do? And that's a big challenge and a big question for me. If I'm so passionate about this, and if I believe in it so much, which I do, then it's completely on me to figure out ways that I can actually scale this for the benefit of society generally. And that's my big question to myself. My big challenge is, how do I go about doing that?
Do you want to say anything else? I've come to the end of our questions, but I don't know whether you want to add anything.
Well, when you put it to me about this topic, and I'm happy to share, I kind of had thought a little bit about, sometimes when I speak with students, I kind of share with them some life lessons. And I think this might be a recap of some of the things we've talked about. So maybe I'll just kind of list them out and as a kind of
definitely.
A way to summarize just my own views on it. So I think there's maybe four quotes that I really like, and then there's lessons that I can talk through. So the quotes are, experience is what you get when you don't get what you want, which I think is very interesting. In other words, that I kind of think a lot about what failure even means. And if you're gaining experience because you've put yourself out there and you've challenged yourself, in my personal experience, it's never been a bad thing. I've only ever grown and learned. And that thing has led me to the next thing. So experience is what you get when you don't get what you want. I really like that quote. I think another one I love is, plans are useless, but planning is indispensable. So the whole process of thinking through a thing and thinking about scenarios and probabilities and what's my best path to impact and what's my various steps and phases that I need to get me to that point of impact, all of that is critically impossible. But then you actually put a plan down, that plan will meet reality, and often reality will cause that plan to change or to not turn out. But all of the logic and the thinking and the prep and everything that you've put into the planning process, that is going to be immensely valuable to you in the real world. So I think I really like that quote for that reason. Another one is kind of around a generalist versus a specialist. You know, I just learned recently, would you believe, the jack of all trades quote, the way it's normally presented to people, is only half the quote. So let me try and get this right. So the normal quote you hear is, a jack of all trades is a master of none, right? And that would kind of make you think that being a generalist is not good and maybe you should be a specialist. But in fact, the full quote is, a jack of all trades is a master of none, but oftentimes better than a master of one. And yeah. I would say, back to our conversation, I notice a lot of people, especially like at PhDs, they become like a world expert in their very particular part of that scientific discipline that they've worked on. And they kind of think, I'm done now. I've got my three letters behind my name. I've published my papers. I'm an expert in this thing. And they kind of forget about growth and they forget about pushing themselves. And also they really pigeonhole themselves very strongly into that one thing. And then they get frustrated wondering why they're not their careers aren't growing, why they're not having more impact. I'm a very strong believer in being an expert in one area, you know, getting the training and everything, but then applying that knowledge and that expertise to a broad set of areas. So I really like that full quote. It's kind of very provocative. And then the other quote I like is go where you are rare. Right. So if you want to have impact and you want to differentiate, you need to put yourself in a position where you're going to stand out. Your contributions, your thoughts are going to be unique. And sometimes that might mean changing fields. It might having your own unique perspectives through how you've engaged with other people from different backgrounds. But this idea, like if you want to progress, you can either be one of the very rare few in your particular discipline that become the world expert in that, or you can start taking that knowledge and experience you have in that area and applying it somewhere else. And all of a sudden you become the expert because you're bringing unique perspectives and insights and all of that. So there are kind of four quotes. And then beyond that, just life lessons. I talk to strangers. You will learn always. It's always a good thing. It's never a bad thing in my view. Always challenge yourself, move into different roles and fields, and just become, if you really want to push yourself and you really want to grow and you want to be a world leader and have massive impact, just become very comfortable with being uncomfortable. And just try and always challenge yourself. And if you start becoming comfortable, just acknowledge that and make an informed decision whether that's where you want to be or whether you want to move the comfort dial back up to being uncomfortable. And what might it take to do that in an area that you're passionate about, that you want to grow in, and where you see impact? And that means that the energy that you apply is just meaningful.
I'm conscious you've mentioned a couple of times, and I think that last piece of advice and the quotes could be kind of targeted to everybody, obviously. And you've mentioned a couple of times STEM PhDs. Do you have any specific advice for arts and humanities PhDs? Or
Yeah, I do. I mean, I work with a lot from the arts and humanities. Typically what I find is folks from those fields can speak in a very esoteric, abstract way. And when they're trying to engage a broader audience, they should realize that the broad audience does not speak that way. They don't comprehend what you're trying to say. That extremely esoteric and abstract approach to talking about humanity and philosophy and life and your work and whatever, practically the vast majority of the world don't comprehend that. So again, if you want to have impact, broad impact at a societal, global, human level, you should understand that and you should embrace learning how to communicate to the broadest audience in the broadest possible way. And some people in those fields worry that that will dilute the value of their work and what they're trying to achieve, but you shouldn't think that way. It'll actually enhance the value of your work. It's not that you're changing your philosophy or your approach or the impact of your work. All you're doing is you're saying, this person over here sees the world a different way. This person over here communicates a different way. I need to help build a translation between how I speak and think to them so that my ideas will have the broadest impact. So, yeah, please, 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 anyone in that field, stop. Just be conscious of the fact that a lot of people don't speak that way. And automatically you're going to alienate a lot of people if you speak that way. Now, you can speak within your community that way if you're comfortable that they all understand it and get it, and if that's the way of communicating. But outside of that, as soon as you want to start expanding your impact, yeah, just realize everyone sees the world a different way, and just don't alienate yourself.
So in a way, the STEM and the arts and humanities have that in common.
They have, and we all do as humans. In fact, humanity has this in common, that we're very poor at communicating generally, right? I mean, it's a big challenge always. It's maybe the biggest challenge always.
Mm-hmm. Donal, it's been absolutely lovely talking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you. You have me bringing up memories and sharing stuff that I haven't got to share before. So it's been fun.
Great. Thanks a million.
Thank you.
We've come to the end of this episode of our podcast, Exploring Research Careers. If you like the podcast, maybe you want to tell your friends and colleagues, or anyone who you think might get benefit from listening to the conversations. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at Eeyore_careers. where you can find new episodes as they're released. In the meantime, thanks for listening and take care.